It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We talk about the presence of forever chemicals, PFAS contamination in drinking water around Wisconsin. PFAS, they were made by chemists in the lab, are used in things like firefighting foam and cosmetics, nonstick cookware, and food packaging like the lining of microwave popcorn bags. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel tested water from 40 homes to get a workup on the presence of PFAS compounds. Join in on PFAS and your drinking water, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Laura Schulte is government agencies and state government reporter for the Journal Sentinel. Laura, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me this morning.
So this investigation, you tested drinking water from around Wisconsin for PFAS compounds. How did you decide which water sources to test?
Yeah, so my reporting partner, Caitlin Farrell, and I started out by looking at a map that was compiled by the Environmental Working Group, looking at potential emitting industries in the state of Wisconsin. And we compared that map of potential emitting industries in different municipalities against, you know, municipalities that had already attested through the state's voluntary sampling program early this year. And then we picked out municipalities that had never sampled for PFAS and then looked at the size of the municipality. If you notice, a lot of the places that we tested were smaller villages and towns. And then we went from there.
You knocked on doors to find residents willing to have their water sampled. What were those exchanges like when they opened the door?
The exchanges were really interesting. And I think one of the most interesting takeaways for us as reporters was finding out that a lot of people didn't know what PFAS were. They had never heard of them. A very small percentage of people had ever heard of the chemicals before. And it was mostly due to the fact that they were firefighters. So they had, you know, knowledge and exposure to, you know, firefighting foam and had learned about it before. So that was one of the most surprising and interesting things that we learned, which kind of made us think, you know, what is the best way for us to, you know, make sure all of these people are informed about what's in their drinking water?
So what did the tests reveal?
Yeah, so we sampled in 40 different municipalities across the state, and the testing revealed that, you know, 12 of those or 30% had levels of PFAS chemicals above new federal recommendations that were released by the Environmental Protection Agency this summer, which essentially said that any detections of PFOA or PFOS are you know, maybe a risk to human health.
What prompted you to test independently? Because the DNR has also been doing testing at sites all over the state.
Yeah, we were just really interested in looking at what was coming out of people's taps on when they were, you know, paying for water from municipal systems. And we thought that it might be a little more impactful to test tap water and say, you know, this is the water coming out of the tap in your home. And do we know what's coming out of it when there isn't widespread testing at this point?
Were any of these samples violating state or federal safety guidelines for PFAS?
None of the samples that we collected were violating state or federal recommendations at this point. We do not have a federal legal limit right now. Mm-hmm. That's something that the EPA is working on. And none of them were above the 70 parts per trillion state legal limit that went into effect this summer.
But still present to some extent. Is that right?
Yeah.
We're talking about the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's investigation of PFAS pollution in Wisconsin's drinking water. Laura Schulte is here, state government reporter for the Journal Sentinel. You can join in on your drinking water in your community. Thoughts on PFAS? Questions? 800-642-1234. Your investigation, Laura, just, I guess, makes me wonder, what does your reporting tell you about the need for testing, or what level of testing in the state is adequate? Because, you know, we've seen the PFAS Action Plan progress report. The Evers administration has said that they've assisted in sampling more than 125 municipal drinking water systems, hundreds of private drinking water wells. So what level of testing is adequate?
Yeah, I think that, you know, what we saw and what we heard from residents whose water we tested is that they just want more testing. They want widespread testing and they want it to be happening frequently. What we know about PFAS is that, you know, they move with the water and, you know, levels can change a little bit, not a whole lot, a little bit. And, you know, to be tracking, you know, accurately, we need to be sampling a little more frequently. And that's what residents were asking for, too. They wanted to make sure that they had the most up-to-date knowledge about what was impacting their drinking water.
Of the 40 households you sampled, had their water supplies ever been tested for PFAS before?
Yeah, so actually, four of the samples that we took were retests of places that had opted into the voluntary sampling program, including Madison, which has been doing its own sampling for years now. And we just decided to do that just to compare the results coming out of the State Lab of Hygiene compared to the private lab that we contracted with, Northern Lake Services.
Were there any noticeable variations?
Yeah, so in Janesville, the state testing showed no detections of any PFAS, and we found a detection of one of the chemicals. And then in Madison, the state testing showed that there was a detect of one chemical, and where we found several chemicals in the Madison supply.
What did, in those areas, what did the water safety people tell you what those variations could mean?
Yeah, in Janesville, when we spoke with the water utility director there, he said, you know, maybe it would be, you know, wise for the homeowner to contract with a plumber and have her system checked for PFAS. But when we talked to some experts, they suggested that, you know, PFAS likely weren't coming from the pipes inside the home. So, you know, the only thing, you know, going forward there is to do more frequent testing, and in Madison, the same too.
So based on this testing you did over the summer, do you have any estimate of how many people could be exposed to unsafe levels of PFAS?
If we're going by the EPA's recommended health advisory levels that they put out this summer, you know, a large number of people are likely impacted by low levels of PFAS in their drinking water. And the 30% detections are not off of, you know, that percentage is not much different from what we've seen with other sampling so far.
Milwaukee Journal Sentinel journalist Laura Schulte with us, exploring her and her colleagues' investigative work to understand the impact of PFAS contamination around our state, testing 40 homes connected to municipal water systems. Join in with your PFAS precautions, concerns in your home, questions you have about the process, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel sampled municipal tap water in dozens of homes around the state, trying to get a better understanding of how widespread PFAS contamination is. Also, the DNR launched an interactive data viewer tool last month that includes dots on a map of known PFAS contamination, as well as where monitoring is underway by the state. Join in on PFAS and your community or household's knowledge of exposure, 800-642-1234. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel journalist, government agencies reporter Laura Schulte stays with us. Laura, we heard from Jeremy in Racine, called in, couldn't stay on the line, but they are wondering why it's taken so long for the Environmental Protection Agency to create federal standards regulating PFAS. Do you have any insights there?
Yeah, so regulating PFAS federally has been an issue because, you know, of course, there has been pushback on that. And, you know, there has been lobbying by, you know, business, by industries that use PFAS routinely, pushback to having, you know, regulations. But there's also the issue that PFAS are so widely used in so many consumer goods. And then there's also the question of how to regulate PFAS. This is a family of chemicals that are, you know, over 10,000 substances big. And how do we, you know, kind of attack that issue? Do we regulate them as a group, or do we regulate them in smaller groups or individually? So those have been some of the questions, you know, that regulators have had to look at. And then just besides the fact that, you know, the wheels of government tend to turn a little slow, so these kinds of things don't happen overnight.
At the state level, too, some lawmakers have wanted federal standards before putting in place state standards. Where are we at with state standards?
Yeah, so this summer, Wisconsin had standards go into place for PFOA and PFOS, which are two of the most well-known and well-researched compounds in the PFAS family. And those are at 70 parts per trillion, either separate or combined, when they're found in water. And that is in drinking water or surface water. And surface water does have some different standards there too, but drinking water is mainly what we're talking about here. Groundwater is still unregulated.
How do Wisconsin's limits compare to states like Michigan or other states?
Wisconsin's limits are a little bit higher than other states in the Midwest, which is something that we explored in our story. So in comparison, in Michigan, the allowable limits for PFOA and PFOS are 16 and 18 parts per trillion. And then in Maine, the limit is 20 parts per trillion for both compounds in comparison to the 70 parts per trillion here in Wisconsin.
Where is that coming from? I mean, what pressure has come from the state business lobby, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, about, you know, 70 parts per trillion, how PFAS is being regulated?
Yeah, so initially, the Department of Health Services here in Wisconsin proposed 20 parts per trillion to be the limit for Wisconsin drinking water. But there was pushback up until the summer. The EPA had older guidelines that were, or recommendations, sorry, that said 70 parts per trillion that were recommended in 2016 under the Obama administration. And so the business lobby kind of pushed for that 70 parts per trillion, for that number then to be dropped much lower this summer.
Let's take a call now. Michael with us in Green Bay. Michael, hi.
Hi, good morning. Quick question. Now that this has been tested and the municipalities have seen the results, has anyone decided, okay, we need to go forward with a remediation plan? Are some of these chemicals even able to be removed, or are some of them not able to be filtered out or adjusted in the groundwater and municipal water?
Michael, thank you. Laura, what action do you see in the water systems you tested at the municipal level?
You know, right, a lot of these really, these low levels that we're seeing, while they are above those health advisory limits, we're not seeing technology that is able to filter PFAS out to that level at this point. In some places like WASA, for example, who had a detection of PFAS above 20 parts per trillion in all of their municipal wells earlier this year, they're installing a granulated activated carbon system, which will be able to remove PFAS to a very low level. But for municipalities that are, you know, below that 20 parts per trillion, which remains the, you know, the health advisory here in Wisconsin, recommended by DHS, you know, municipalities aren't taking action at levels at this point.
But I think beginning this month, the DNR is going to begin testing all public water systems quarterly under the new state regulations. How will that work? How will that roll out?
Yeah, so starting on November 1st, the DNR's testing requirements went into effect kind of on a rolling basis, kind of designated by the size of the municipality. So right now, the larger municipalities are going to have to start sampling this month and submitting quarterly and then submitting those results to the DNR. So places like Madison, Milwaukee, Janesville, for example, are, you know, had to begin their sampling program and submit those results to the DNR. And then in January, there will be, you know, medium-sized municipalities. And then starting in April, small municipalities will start having to start sampling quarterly. So we'll see those results coming out, and we'll likely know, you know, where municipalities in the state stand with public water systems, you know, by next spring.
And those results would be public knowledge. I mean, I would imagine that they would that would be published, you know, along with what else is in your drinking water. Or how might the transparency work there?
Yeah, I think that, you know, a really good way to look at that would probably be through the DNR's new PFAS data viewer that was released last month. And another way would be to check out your consumer confidence report that comes from your drinking water system every year. So, you know, you're getting other information about other contaminants that water systems have to routinely test for. And now that they have to begin sampling for PFAS, you'll probably see some data about PFAS showing up in that report.
We're talking about PFAS pollution in Wisconsin's drinking water systems. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Laura Schulte is with us. Still time to talk about PFAS, 800-642-1234. Laura, if someone is worried about whether their water is contaminated with PFAS, what options do they have?
Yeah, if you're really worried about PFAS contamination, of course, there's the option to test your own water. But, you know, the tests for PFAS are expensive. You know, they start at, you know, $360 a piece, depending on the lab that you're sending them to. But there are other actions that you can take. The National Sanitation Foundation has a list of filters that have been rated to remove PFAS, you know, from tap water. So, you know, you could get a pitcher that kind of looks like a Brita to put your water through. Or, you know, there are also options for whole house filters or under the sink filters that just filters all of the water coming out of your sink.
Does that take care of the problem completely? And what about the cost?
Yeah, the cost can be prohibitive. And that's one of the issues in dealing with PFAS right now, is kind of trying to figure out how to reduce the cost to individuals who are worried about this issue.
The DNR, you know, as you talk about people worried about this issue, the DNR has this external advisory group giving feedback to state regulators about PFAS pollution. They have another meeting next month, and do you see citizens' concern about this issue pushing lawmakers to take action?
Yeah, we have seen citizens really, you know, come together and, you know, talk to and go to legislators about this. And what we've kind of seen is a little bit of partisan gridlock on PFAS issues. A lot of times, you know, action is being, you know, proposed by one side and declined by the other. And I think that, you know, PFAS, like many of the issues in our state, have kind of been caught up in that partisan gridlock.
What are your next steps for PFAS and monitoring this issue?
You know, keeping a really close eye on what the Environmental Protection Agency is doing right now. They are supposed to release their suggested legal federal recommendations for drinking water by the end of this year. So really keeping a close eye there. And, you know, just keeping a close eye on groundwater regulations. So those are in the works once again by the DNR. So we will, you know, be getting a first look at what those recommended limits for groundwater could be, you know, in the coming 6 months.
And I want to just, in our few moments left together, give a plug to your public investigator statewide initiative. Can you tell us what has been launched here, you know, in light of this PFAS investigation?
Yeah, so the Journal Sentinel is looking, you know, for tips. Is there an issue that you want public investigator to look into? You know, feel free to send, you know, an email, you know, to our public investigator tip line. We want to hear your tips. We want to chase leads and uncover the truth across our state, anywhere in Wisconsin.
Laura, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on today.
Laura Schulte is government agencies and state government reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We have a link to their PFAS investigative reporting. It's at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss rising interest rates now and what it means for the home buying process in Wisconsin. High prices, rising mortgage rates, tight inventory, all pushing home buying out of reach for many people, especially shutting out first-time home buyers. That's new data from the National Association of Realtors. Join in on mortgages, what you've discovered about the housing market where you are, 800-642-1234. Chris Oley is a mortgage loan officer at UW Credit Union. Chris, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, we've had our eyes closely watching the Federal Reserve. They ordered another big boost in interest rates last week and warned that more is to come to wrangle inflation. Can you explain how the Fed's rate hikes directly affect mortgage rates and our borrowing costs for a home?
Well, they're related because what the Fed does impacts the economy, or at least how people see the economy, and then those reactions, and they trickle down to mortgage-backed securities, which impact house prices, interest rates for house loans. But they don't have a direct impact on mortgage rates. It's part of the whole system. But of course, as you said, the Fed is trying to rein in inflation so that it doesn't get entrenched and become a much longer problem. And they're doing what they think they need to do, and we have to stick along with that. But as far as home buying, it's still happening. While sales are down and listings are down and inventory is down, there's still action there people are finding. But it's more of a struggle for sure.
As you see mortgage rates topping 7% for the first time in two decades, what is the impact on your work and the amount of customer traffic you see for people seeking to get pre-approved for a mortgage these days?
It's reduced. You know, it's just there's the element of uncertainty with inflation people have. There's the lack of resources to keep up with those prices and each the house prices and the interest rates. So things have diminished quite a bit from, like, you know, the last 2 years during the pandemic. It was high prices, but low rates. And that helped people refinance. But things are much slower. But there's still people looking for houses. And I logged in today to start this interview, and someone just sent me an email indicating they have an accepted offer. And that's always great to know. It's not as common as it's been, but it still happens.
Like you mentioned there, sellers have seemed to call the shots for at least 2 years in the housing market. And now it seems like that might be changing. Are housing markets in Wisconsin still very competitive for buyers making an offer?
I think it's softened up a bit. I mean, basically the data from the Wisconsin Realtor Association and even in our local Dane County market, things have softened up. And we've even heard of, you know, through direct contracts I've seen, there are concessions now that the sellers are giving, whether it's on price or closing costs, or even there's buy downs people are looking at. So it's turning. I think there are still some houses that have competition. I did get an accepted offer on Friday that was multiple countered, means there was multiple people offering at the same time. So that's still happening, but the prices have softened and sellers are giving some things to help move the house.
You just mentioned buy downs, these, you know, temporary buy downs to reduce the home buyer's monthly payments in the first year or maybe first 2 or 3 years. How do they work?
Well, the idea is that right, rates are high. And what can make a house more affordable is a lower interest rate. So you get a loan that instead be 7%, let's say it's 6% for the first year. And that might save you $50, $80 a month or something in interest cost. And that presumably makes the house more affordable. And that contract can then be fulfilled and buy the house. The other side of the fence, though, is that you're going to pay a fee up front in most cases to get that discount. So you really have to weigh the value of that discount. And there's different kinds of buy downs and versions of it. The idea, though, is if you have to pay a large fee up front to get that interest rate savings, could that fee money be used for something different or more impactful? And does the interest rate difference actually make the house more affordable or just defer the fact that you're going to pay more up front? So it's always good to do calculations, but those are more popular now because of the inflation and the interest rates.
Yeah, who or what is paying the interest rate savings there for the buyer in those early years or year?
Well, the idea is the lender says they're, I mean, I saw a commercial for something where the lender said that, you know, they'll
Yes,
pay
we've
1%
seen the
here.
commercials.
And I just saw that
Which
like the
shall
other day.
remain nameless, but carry on.
Yeah, I intend to keep it nameless. But the idea is that they have these inflation slashers or whatever. And the point is that they the lender's saying they'll pay that interest for you up front. Well, anything's possible, but you always want to look at when there's a miracle solution, what is the snake oil they're selling? And so usually it's they're not really selling you or paying your interest for you. They're just going to charge you a one-time fee to get that lower interest. And I think the plan would be that you have the seller pay that fee for you. And if the seller is willing to pay that fee for you, then you don't pay for that discount and there's value. Again, however, maybe that discount or sorry, the fee the seller's paying for you could be applied in another way. So it's always good to understand the full scope of what's in front of you.
Yeah, go line by line on those closing costs. Talking about buying and refinancing houses with Chris Ole, Wisconsin-based mortgage loan officer. You can join in on the housing market where you are. Questions you have on mortgages, 800-642-1234. Chris, in markets like these, I always wonder, do higher interest rates do they make it harder to qualify for a home loan?
Well, I think that empirically, if the rate's higher, the monthly payment's going to be higher. So, if for the same situation, so rates are twice as much as they were yesterday's, or sorry, yesterday, last year. So we have that relationship. Yeah,
Feels
things
like
cost more.
yesterday.
Yeah, things are moving fast. So, in that case, yes, they cost more. But I think for the folks that I work with and see, most people understand their finances in a way that, when they're looking to spend money on housing and what their housing payment looks like, they know how to spend within what their means, what they would plan to spend. So because of that, I don't feel like it makes it less affordable for them. It might take out some of those options to compete with other houses in certain areas that they might have appreciated because they could have got more for their dollar, but then also there was more competition. So I think it always depends on the market. It's a micro situation when it comes to house prices and negotiations and things. But I also think that higher rates have actually cost more, but the amount you were going to spend on housing has increased, but not outside your range. And for most people
And I know
that
you're
I work with.
gonna, and you're gonna say it depends here, but should people wait this out for mortgage rates to drop before buying a home? Should they just keep saving up, or do you think now it might be a good time because those rates could keep going up?
Well, Kate, it depends.
Let's say it together.
Yeah, it always depends. We can't get sound bites to solve everything. But I think one thing in my view is that when you're ready to make that step to be a homeowner, and that's what you want to do because of the various reasons that are important to you, you buy now, whether that's this week or next year. You buy when the right house is available and you can afford to buy it. You don't wait because houses are unique. Every house is individual. Even if they're the same house on the same street, they're different geolocations. So the main thing is you buy the right house for you when it's available and you can afford it because that house might not be for sale next year and rates might be higher or lower next year. The one thing about mortgages in particular is people get really agitated when rates rise, but rates go through cycles and we're all expecting, everybody's expecting rates to continue to go through cycles. And if you buy a house with a high rate now, good chance you'll be refinancing that mortgage in the future.
Yes, and that is true, but refinancing comes with costs as well. It's not, I would say that first of all, there's no guarantee that rates will come down in a manner that works with a person's finances, but also refinancing costs and what could that home buyer expect if they do try to refinance down the road?
Well, as we say, it depends, but closing costs for mortgages can range. There's the empirical cost to produce a loan, like the appraisal cost and things. And most people pay $1,500 to $2,000 to have a loan produced. So you'd expect to pay something like that. But there are a variety of loan products that cover, and there's loans that pay your closing costs. There's loans that have very low closing costs in concession of the rate. But I think the one thing, Kate, I think about is that buying a house and the idea that you that you know you're going to wait out something, and then and rates may go higher or they won't refinance. But this is buying a house is not about the money. This is my viewpoint here. I think you're buying it for quality of life. You're buying to improve and create memories, and that's the value of this. So if you're going to compare another set of closing costs to all the photos of your child as they go to school every day outside your front door, I think that's not really you can't equate those things.
Painting a picture there. So here is the magic question, though: how can I get a lower interest rate on my mortgage? What are some tips that you have to get the best rate out there?
Well, mortgage rates are definitely tied to a variety of things, but one, of course, market prices are a big one. But your credit score is important. Having a strong credit score, having scores at 740 or above are going to give you the best possible rates available. So that's one thing to work on. If you're planning to buy next year, it's good to come in early and talk about things, especially if your credit can find some places to improve on. If your credit's already in that 740 range, nothing more you can do. The other idea of improving your rates with some of those quick fixes, there's those buy downs, but be very cautious and understand the terms of that so you can get into it. And the third alternative is adjustable rate mortgages, which offer usually discounted rates for a number of years in the beginning, and then they reset and change after.
Is that a better deal right now than a 30-year fixed going with the ARM, the adjustable rate mortgage? What are the pros and cons?
Well, they are very popular right now, especially when fixed rates are high, adjustable rates shine. And that's just because people do believe loans go through cycles, or maybe their holding period with the home is shorter than what they would expect, if they're not going to live there forever, an adjustable loan works. The downside is the rate's going to change. The upside is you save a lot of money in the front end. There's lower closing costs usually, and the interest rate's lower by 1% or more, and so you can save quite a bit. But that comparison always depends on the person's comfort level and what the changes will be. I sell quite a few adjustable mortgages right now for the exact reasons I just went through and the risk tolerance of the consumer, but still a lot of people still buy fixed rate loans.
Is there a ceiling on those ARMs? I mean, is there a top to how high the rate can go?
Yes. Every ARM that we sell, and the ones I'm familiar with in the marketplace, there's a max interest rate. So they have to call it the lifetime cap, where the rate cannot exceed. Mm-hmm. And then when the rates do change, they have annual or monthly caps, depending on what kind of adjustable mortgage it is. So it can't exceed certain increment adjustments, and then it has a lifetime max as well.
Wisconsin-based mortgage banker Chris Ole breaking down the home buying process in challenging economic times. Join in on your home buying experience, where you're at in the process, what happened when you put in offers, what the counteroffer was like. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here as we look at those headwinds in the home buying process. We get insights from a Wisconsin mortgage loan officer. The National Association of Realtors' new report profiling buyers and sellers found a big jump in how far a buyer moved from their previous residence, an all-time high of 50 miles. The report cited work from home, factoring in hybrid work, also factoring in. Join in on the house hunt, where you're at with it, questions you have, 800-642-1234. We have mortgage banker Chris Ole, who stays with us. Chris, we've been talking about refinancing there. Do you have any tips or insights? How much should you, or how long should you wait for rates to fall in order to refinance? What is that formula like when you should take that step to refinance?
Well, as we say, it depends, but really a half a point in the rate is usually enough to make it valued. So, you know, with closing costs, we mentioned them earlier, you know, they could be a couple thousand or so. If you can recover that savings in 2 years time, a half a point usually can do that for most average loan amounts. And so that's a good measure, but it always depends, because if your fees are a lot higher or your loan balance is a lot lower, that relationship isn't always the same, but half a point or more is what I normally recommend.
Also, as you mentioned, it depends on how long you might stay in the home as well, very much factoring in on whether you refinance that mortgage. Something that really struck me is how real estate can be considered this hedge against inflation because it offers people a way to lock in part of their monthly budget, which is the roof over their head. What do you make of that argument that it's a hedge against inflation?
Well, I think that's a great argument. I think about it in a couple different ways. You know, I think consumers feel it immediately when they say, I want to stop paying rent because my rent keeps changing, keeps going up. Although that might soften up too with the changes in the inflation. But I do. That makes sense, especially that was one of the big values. I mentioned I'm much more of an emotional home buyer in the sense that I believe it's for quality of life and sustainability and growing roots and having, you know, a community. But the value, financial value of having rent control that you own, I think is a very good plus too.
Looking at the monthly income of someone, I mean, I've heard that a housing payment should max out at 25%, 28% to 30% of my pre-tax income. I'm wondering, is that accurate, or what is a realistic percentage this day and age to use for housing as what portion of your income?
Well, that's a big question. A lot of times, in fact, many buyers that come our way will ask, you know, what can I afford? They ask us this question, and really, it's turned around on what you as the buyer, you the home prospective buyer, are thinking about spending on housing and that relationship between your income. Some people travel a lot and go to the movies first run on the weekend and spend money lavishly on fancy gifts. So they want to have a lower housing payment because their budget can sustain a lower payment. Whereas other folks get Netflix and they like to garden and they're homebodies. And so they could spend a higher portion of their income. So it definitely depends on the person themselves. And I think that when we look at it as a consultative arrangement here, we talk through people and their situations. Everybody's different. The old school 25, 26% of your income on housing, I think, is a prudent number to have out there, but it really depends on how people spend money. And especially today, I think a lot of folks are pushed a little bit higher to get that house just because, you know, rates are higher and house prices are higher, so they have to adjust a bit.
How quickly do you have to move as a mortgage banker in order to get your clients into these homes in order for their offers to get accepted? What is competition like for you?
Well, I think when we're talking about a transaction and how the lender's involved, you know, the most transactions take about a month, but there's variations. Sometimes they're a little bit faster. Sometimes they take longer. There's some contracts that are even months out, but about a month's time, because the industry understands that there's certain things that have to happen, you know, just simple things like people have to make moving arrangements after the, you know, transaction's been solidified. So a month's time is usually what it is, but on the front end, just like I was talking about getting people communicate with me when they have accepted offers, a lot of times people communicate that they're going to make an offer and they need help with what I call a customized pre-approval letter to help give them a little, not really an edge, but a little bit of grease on the wheels to that contract. And so we have to be very, you know, in the moment and help those people get that offer in, the members get those offers in, so that they have an opportunity to get, you know, the contract.
How important are those pre-approval letters in these times?
I think it's, I kind of equate it to playing baseball with a glove. If you play baseball without a glove, you're at a disadvantage because everybody else has got one. So I think with the pre-approval letter, it's a little bit, it's not just you need it. That's part of the process at this point. And it's been like that for a long time. I think the generic pre-approval letters from, you know, just printed off the internet because you applied on a website, aren't the ones you want to have. You want one customized. You want one that the lender has actually viewed the offer. I'm sorry, viewed your application to make sure that, you know, everything is in order. And I think also I want to point out that many prospective home buyers get pre-approved, but they don't even really know what they're pre-approved for. They have some idea of a price point, you know, $250,000 or something, but they really don't know what the underlying loan and the cost to get that loan. So I really encourage people to, when you get pre-approved, know what you're pre-approved for.
Talking about buying and refinancing houses with Chris Oley, a Wisconsin-based mortgage loan officer. You can join in with your questions about the home buying process, what you see out there, 800-642-1234. Chris, what are the all cash offers you're seeing out there these days? Are they still pretty common, and where are you seeing them?
Well, as mortgage lender, I often don't see them because generally cash offers, if they're paying cash, they don't need
financing. Need you.
Yes. However, there's often times where there are buyers who can pay cash, but they elect not to. So then they come to the lender. So I see those from time to time, of course, because it's prudent to borrow money and not spend all your money on something, because then you don't have your money to do other things with. So especially when mortgage rates were historically low last year or so, it was kind of silly not to borrow money. It was so inexpensive. But I don't see those very often, but it is happening. And I think not as much as now, because the market is softer. There's less buyers, less inventory. Houses are on the market a little bit longer. But on the other side, in the summertime, when there was, if you hear all the buzz and the houses were going so fast and for high, you know, 100 grand over list price in these weird situations, those cases for sure, buyers with cash were coming out on top because the seller didn't have to worry about any other conditions. They knew they were just going to get the money.
So we only have a few moments left, but if you can think of one piece of advice to make for first-time home buyers, what would that advice be?
Well, I can't really distill it down to one thing, but I think this is a challenging time because rates are higher, not like last year, but the competition is slowing down, so you're going to have a better opportunity. I think the main thing is you set up a plan and you stick to that plan. So when you have an idea of what you want to spend on housing, and you might, you know, talk with your loan officer to consult about where that line is for you, how much you want to spend, but have a plan and stick to it and don't get swept up into the current of activity with competition and things. Because as a first time home buyer, many of us, like myself, had a modest down payment to start and we didn't have deep pockets to throw around. So make a plan and stick to it. Definitely ask questions.
Chris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Chris Oley is a mortgage loan officer at UW Credit Union. And for disclosure, UW Credit Union is a Wisconsin Public Radio business sponsor. Miss any part of the show today? You can visit our program page anytime. Find hundreds of morning show programs in our archives. It's at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.